In today's interview, I'm delighted to be joined by James Lowen, Senior Fund Manager at J.A. Hambro. James has over 30 years industry experience. He's a qualified chartered accountant and started his career in auditing for KPMG, moving on to equity research for 7 years at Newton Investment Management, before joining J.A. Hambro in September 2004. James co-manages the J.A. Hambro UK Equity Income Fund alongside Clive Beagles. He holds a first-class degree in economics from the University of Exeter and is an associate member of the Institute of Investment Management and Research.
We need to see more trips to see companies. And then another good medium is a dinner, because you can get 2 or 3 hours. You'll have people who own the shares and then new people that they can pitch to, and then we'll give our feedback.
So welcome to the podcast, James, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
So can we start by talking a little bit about your career history?
Yeah, so I've always wanted to be a fund manager. I started investing when I was about 13. I can remember the first stock I bought, which was Plessy, in my father's name. So that was a start of the interest. I went to Exeter University because a quarter of the degree was writing equity research. And then after that, I tried to get into fund management, but it was very difficult, and it still is. So I then went to do accounting, which turned out to be a very good basis for what we do here in terms of the micro at KPMG. And then after that, I started applying for fund management jobs again, roles again. And I think I applied for over 30 roles, and the answer was always no. And I was nearly giving up when I got the job offer to work as an analyst at Newton. I worked there for 7 years. That's where I met Clive. He was the fund manager there. And then 21 years ago now, we both left there together and joined J.A. Hambro. And it's a very interesting job, because you're in the middle of all the micro, the macro, geopolitics, what's going on in Russia. You've got the privilege of meeting all the company executives. So it's a very interesting role.
Just to pick up on something you said, I mean, obviously there's a lot of contraction in terms of UK investment banking teams currently. Any tips for candidates looking still to break into equity research or those types of roles?
Well, I think it's very difficult, like I said, because the market's shrinking. Obviously, there's more passive, which is taking assets away from active, which is where most of the manpower is. So I do a lot of work with Exeter University. I do guest lectures, and I let people shadow me. And so when I'm talking to them about how they should approach this, I think they've got to be innovative. They've got to show interest, not just do their academics. They've got to show interest in the areas, and then try and go into an areas that are growing. So data into fund management is growing. ESG has rolled over a bit, but it's still a sort of growth area. So I think you've got to be quite innovative, or go into accounting. So I do think that's quite a good basis in terms of the accounting and the micro and understanding companies ready to speak to management. So there's a number of routes in, but it was difficult when I started, and it's very, very difficult now, I'd say.
Obviously, a very impressive 30-year career to date, which you don't look like you've had. What have been the most significant changes you've seen in fund management, and in like particular, how does this compare maybe to the role 10 to 20 years ago?
Well, the frustrating thing at the moment, which is one of the changes that happened, if you go back to 2009, when we're coming out of the financial crisis, the valuation structure of the UK market was the same then as it is now. But what you had then is you had our client base and the general market reacting to the low valuations. So they'd allocate into UK equities, despite news still being quite bad. It was getting less bad. That was a signal why we got the increased allocation. What is not happening now is there's no valuation reaction. So we can talk about, and we probably will talk about, the low valuation of the UK market. That should be leading to increased allocations, which would sort the issue out and move us closer to where the global equity market and asset markets trade, but that's not happening. So that's quite frustrating. So that's one thing I think has changed. The other thing is volatility. The markets are a lot more volatile now. I think that's because the average investment horizon is very short. Mine's remains quite long. We look at stocks on a sort of 3-year perspective, but the average market participant is much shorter than that. So when you have earnings results, like we're just coming through the bank results season, although the results are very good, you get knee-jerk reactions. So it takes a few weeks to iron out. Now, that is frustrating in a way, but it creates opportunities in another sense, because where we know, as we do on all our stocks and holdings, where we are in terms of our target prices, our fundamentals, then we can take advantage of some of that volatility. So that's frustrating, but can be rewarding on a sort of medium term basis. I think the final change that's happened is the sell side, which obviously we work very closely with, has been hollowed out to a degree, and there's lots of consolidation happening now, which is quite interesting. And companies pulling out, like HSBC has just pulled out of their equity capital markets and their broking operations from a company perspective. We'll see what they do in terms of the side that faces us. But we've got less sort of quality and less quantity of research, if you like. Now, we're quite lucky because we've been doing this, like you said, and I said at the start, for 30 years. We've got our favoured relationships in each sector. So in house building, I know the two analysts that we are go-to analysts for Clive and I, and we work with them. We've sort of held relationships like that, and that helps us. But on a broader basis, it's been hollowed out because of what's happened to the industry profit pool, but also regulatory changes like MiFID.
Three really interesting points there, which maybe let's tackle in order. First, you talked about UK valuation discount. I mean, how much of an impact do you think fund outflows have had on UK valuation, and what do you think needs to happen for those to start to recover, if possible?
Well, it's been like a desert. I mean, it's felt like running up an escalator since we started, because funds have been throwing out of active and into passive and out of UK into global. They're the two big trends. So even though we're one of the best performing funds over the 20 years, it's been hard for us to sort of maintain our poise, if you like, from an asset perspective. There's been a couple of flickers of light at the end of the tunnel, if you like. One was before the election, when it looked like Labour could pick the baton up and run quite well with it. Obviously, that's not what they've done until recently, when they've sort of changed tack a bit. And then once at the end of it last year, when we had the first monthly inflow from an industry perspective into UK equities, that was November. But that's dissipated since in December and January. So it's quite tricky. I think what we need is sort of what is happening already and what could happen on a policy basis. So what's happening already is corporates are recognising the value. So we've had a record year for M&A last year. We call it the UK market under attack. And I think we're going to see more of that this year. It won't start until the final results are out, because anyone who's going to launch a bid will wait to see the financial position for the end of last year. So I think this will all start from sort of March onwards. We had six bids in the fund out of 60 stocks last year, and four of those consummated. So that's one factor. The other factor is the performance of companies is very good at the moment. It's the opposite of when we're in a financial crisis. Then it was profit warnings and rights issues. Now it's buybacks and positive results in the main. But I think we've got a bigger problem that the government are going to need to tackle. And there's lots of mood music around this, because we're seeing a tax base hollowed out as companies leave, right, flutter, or the market shrinks by buybacks or M&A. And the IPO market, which we'll probably talk about in a minute, is dead at the moment because of this valuation architecture. So what we're expecting and hoping the government will do, and like I said, there's lots of mood music around this, is to change policy to twist this flow picture into UK equities. So two things they could do, which are being discussed, is one, mandate pension funds to have a certain allocation in UK equities. So we would like to hear, for example, that pension funds, which gets lots of tax breaks, we spend about 50 billion a year as a country for tax breaks for pensions, have a minimum allocation of just 10% into UK equities, which is twice where it is at the moment. So that would be a game changer. The other thing they could do is there's about 350 billion in cash ISAs. They could change the emphasis there and say there isn't going to be a cash ISA and all ISA allowances have to go into UK stocks. The more dramatic version of that is if they said the stock of cash ISAs had to change over 2 years into stocks and shares. I think that's less likely. So there's a couple of things that I think is on their agenda, but they're going to have to act, because this is, we've sort of used the analogy of a melting ice lolly, and that's what we're seeing at the moment in terms of the UK equity market.
Are you lobbying at all? I know you obviously you publish your thoughts on the UK market alongside Clive. Are you involved in any sort of lobbying to the government?
Well, we do on a sort of soft basis. We've done stuff with when the Conservatives are there. We knew that his head of economic strategy. We meet people like Charles Hall. He's very good to follow on LinkedIn, and Sir Nicholas Lyon, who's the chairman of one of our companies. He was a Lord Mayor of the City of London, so he's very involved in this. So there's lots going on, and this is the mood music I talked about. So I think we'd be unsurprised, or we'd be surprised if nothing happens this year on this front.
What are you seeing? Obviously, you meet with lots of company management teams. How do you kind of counsel them when, you know, they're coming in unhappy with the valuation of the stock? You might find yourselves in a situation where you've got two stocks, both with significant upside, having to sell out of one to buy into the higher upside. What's your interaction with your company management teams, or your advice that you'd give to company management teams on handling this situation?
So there's probably two sort of streams there. So the first one is the last 10 minutes of every meeting with management is exactly on this. The boardrooms in the UK are deeply frustrated with the valuation. So they're delivering, like I said, from a micro perspective. They've done things like buybacks. They've increased the dividends. I've got over half my fund is buying back shares at the moment. So if you're in a minority. They've increased communication. I will talk a bit about that later, maybe. So they've done a lot of things they could do. The other, so there's frustration. The other thing that all companies are worried about is a takeover, going back to how many stocks are being taken over, or an activist investor. We've obviously seen BP come under Elliott's gaze in the last 10 days, if we read what we read in papers. So they're all concerned about that. So they all want to be doing stuff to sort of get ahead of that. And we're starting to see companies do things internally, like Legal & General last week did their US transaction. ITV earlier last year sold BritBox, for example. So we're seeing a lot more recognition of this and sort of action by companies wanting to do stuff before they get bid for. The other thing we're doing is where companies are less keen to engage in that discussion or have sort of slipped on a banana skin, if you like, we're putting more pressure on them. So we're being more active in a constructive way. So some of this we do publicly, but most of it's done privately. And we'll just try and put ideas forward. None of them are extremes that would pass the test of common sense or the test of most of the shareholders. And there's certain sectors where valuations are in limbo. For example, small cap mining, where we've suggested companies should sell themselves because they're never going to unlock from that. Even if we get the UK picture better, like we talked about, there's other specific issues. Single country, single commodity risk, but the market's not valuing properly. So we've become a lot more active behind the scenes, mainly in certain areas to try and unlock value. And that's probably been one of the other trends of the last 5 years because of this valuation backdrop.
How would you like companies to respond where you're engaging with them in this manner? So I'm assuming you write a letter initially to the chairman or to the board. Do you go through brokers as well when you're providing this kind of feedback? And just interested in how you'd like to engage your companies in this manner.
We on most of the companies, particularly the ones in the below the top 50, say, we have detailed engagements all year. So our small or mid cap, we'll talk to them between 6 and 10 times a year. So every time they have a trading update, we'll talk to them and obviously results meetings and any other ad hoc meetings. They also seek our advice. So for example, one of our companies was employing a new broker in the last couple of weeks. And when they've got down to the last two, they asked our view as a sort of senior shareholder. We own 10% of that stock. So there's lots of engagement. And normally it's very, you know, they want our views. And it's a sort of two-way process. I think it's a minority where we have to write a letter. We probably write 3 or 4 letters a year. They take a long time to do, because you've got to get all your facts right. So it's probably a day it takes to write a detailed letter arguing the case. That either follows a chairman meeting or will be before a chairman meeting. And then we've seen some companies, like in the small cap property sector, that's another sector sort of trapped in its jacket from a valuation perspective. We've seen a couple of our companies change their boards, like Palace Capital, and then change their strategy, wind up to liberate value. It's a lot easier now, I'd say, to engage boards than it was 5 years ago. And it comes back to this frustration with valuations point.
And while we're on the subject of UK equity market valuation, what are you seeing in terms of IPOs? I mean, it's been a dearth like of IPO activity in London over the last couple of years. Any signs of that recovering, or was that intrinsically linked to the valuation discount?
I think it is. Obviously, we've seen positive moves in terms of listing requirements, which is good. But the big elephant in the room is valuation, because why would I sell a stock that's got 50 to 100% upside to buy an IPO? Now, presumably, they're selling it. If they thought theirs had 50 to 100% upside, they wouldn't sell it. And they're not going to want to sell it on a discount to what they think it's worth. So there's a massive gap at the moment, which is stopping IPO activity. We had the odd one, like Raspberry Pi was the highlight last year. Every now and then we do pilot fishing meetings. We did one with a financial recently, but the financial sector that's quoted has got significant upside. So it's a very high bar it'd have to meet in terms of differentiation, in terms of growth, in terms of valuation, for us to sort of sell what we've got to buy what's coming potentially for this sort of new gate.
So was it a blow to London where we see stocks like Unilever ice cream business announcing they're going to be listing in Europe, for example, as well?
Yeah. So you've got that, which was obviously interesting yesterday with Unilever, and also this BP situation. You know, only about 3 or 4% of BP's earnings is in the UK. They're bigger in the US than Exxon, but they're on twice the rating of Exxon. So one of Elliott's views, if we read again what we hear in papers, is where they should be listed. And there's always rumors around Shell where they should be listed. I saw a stat this morning that Clive was telling me that only 4% of Glencore's shareholders are London institutions. So boards are under pressure, and that's why it goes back to what I said about the government. They need to act quickly, otherwise we're going to see one of these marquee top 10 stocks move, and that it'll be after that happens that they'll go into action. So we should be going into action now to stop this happening.
Let's start to talk a little bit about how you and Clive manage your fund. And in particular, I'm interested in how you screen companies. So what companies might be able to do to potentially get on your radar. And then you also talked about the sort of impacts of volatility, particularly in the context of shorter term investment making decisions. What's the average sort of time frame over which you're holding a stock, or does that vary?
So the average since we started 20 years ago has been about between 4 or 5 years. So this is a long-term process. The holding periods go down a little bit when we're performing well, because we're rotating out of stocks that have performed well on higher valuations into lower valuation stocks. So that's what causes the variability. So it is quite a long-term strategy. And like I said earlier, we're focused on what stocks can earn on a three-year view. We call it normalized earnings. So for most of our stocks, we've got this normalized earnings picture, which is what can this stock earn with this management in this sector, with this macro, within the competitive set it is in, with the strategy the management's got. And we'll take our view on valuation based on that. So that's the sort of holding period. In terms of how we sift through things, we can only own half the market, because our process is that every stock yields more than the market average. So that means half the market's not there. And also, because of the size of the fund, which is 2.2 billion, the strategy at the moment, we can only go down the market cap strata so much. There's only about 200, 225 stocks that we can actually own. Now, most of those we know, because we've been doing it so long, like you said earlier. So it's not a question of there's thousands of stocks and we need to use, you know, AI techniques or data techniques to sort of sift them. So we know most of them. We know where they are in their life cycles. Some of those we won't own in any case, because they might be too levered, for example, or we might have concerns over accounting, for example, or we don't like the sector, or they might be over-earning, for example, so their normalized earnings are lower than where current earnings are. So we're sort of in touch across that universe, and then we've got the 60 stocks we own out of that, and then we've got a pipeline of 10 that we're working on, and when we're working on them, we'll be engaging with what's out there generally, and then after we've done all of that work, we'll then go on to meet the management. That's how we typically build up the work on the stock.
You mentioned you've got a pool of kind of trusted analysts that you've worked with over the years, and you'd also touched on obviously the
decline and contraction in particularly small and mid-cap research as a result of MiFID II. So how are your broker interactions changing in response to these?
So there's probably less overall, and we're doing more proprietary work ourselves, particularly around this normalized earnings. But we still do have meetings. So, for example, this week we had a meeting with who we regard as the top house building analyst and building and construction team. And they've been in situ about 10 years. As you know, so they're long standing, they're very good. They think about things a bit similarly to us, so not short term or longer term. So there's still that going on sector by sector, particularly around when we want to review a sector or we're looking at new stocks. Where things are less is, I think, on sales contact, because the sales side, the sales forces of the analysts have been reduced even more than analysts. So, you know, if you go back 20 years and you sat next to Clive and I, the phones would be going all day. And, you know, if you sat by us today, you'd think it's a bit like a library because there's less phone calls coming in. A lot of it's done on IB. So this is a Bloomberg chat system or emails. So a lot of it's done electronically versus where it was before. And the other thing that's happened is we've disintermediated the sell side. So if you go back 30 years ago, with NatWest results have come out on the day we're recording this. I've listened to that at a results meeting, you know, live. I've heard all the questions from analysts. If you go back 30 years, you had to be invited in person to it. There wasn't any live webcast. So we had to wait for analysts to come out of the meeting to then call their clients to hear what happened in the meeting. So now we're doing all that directly. And like I said earlier, the ability to contact companies is very high, and they encourage it. So as soon as we've seen a trading update from one of the smaller companies, we'll go on and say, can we have a quick call with the company? So there's a bit of disintermediation happened as well, as sort of quantity and quality gone down on that side.
Quite a left field question. There's a lot of emerging AI technology. Would you start to leverage technology like that to be more efficient, or do you still prefer to actually hear the management deliver the message themselves?
Yeah, I mean, some of my colleagues, one of the other UK fund managers, not Clive, who sits opposite me, he prefers to read transcripts rather than listen. He picks up the key points like that. I prefer the opposite. So I prefer, like I did today, listening to the conference call, because it gives the context. You can hear the sort of tone of the answer and the questions and the confidence. And then that is a very good build up into then meeting the companies when we meet them one on one after the results. And it's also a key part of our process when we're reviewing a company. So we'll go onto their website and look at the last two or three analyst meetings and watch them. So we can see how things have changed and built up, and then as well as current results before we tend to meet a management.
Is there anything that frustrates you about the way companies are presenting information? Or
there's still a few old school companies that don't like, that just like analysts at meetings, or don't have a live recording, or then even fewer don't put it on their website after because they think it's competitive for competitive reasons. But that's a minority now, but there's a few companies like that, which we complain about because we think there should be proper full transparency. In terms of how companies trade themselves, and again, this has got better, a lot better than it was, but we don't like spin. We like or lots of adjustments, or where the cash doesn't follow the profits if there are lots of adjustments. So we like companies just to say it how it is. We don't like the word broadly, because broadly tends to mean it's not delivered. And you can see through a lot of this with experience, and obviously we know what we're expecting. So I think clean, transparent, less adjustment, cash following the profits, and honesty, consistency, you know, that's what we're looking for from companies.
Any other sort of red flags from a financial disclosure perspective that might put you off investing in a company? You've talked about profit.
Yeah, I think the cash flow versus profits is a big one. You know, when you go back over the decades, you know, that is always the one where if mistakes are made, can be made. So you've got to be rigorous with looking at that relationship. And
understanding it. There will always be timing differences. So that's one thing. Where there's a second thing would be where there's lots of exceptional items per year, and then it's not exceptional. So one of our messages to companies is to get those down and try to eradicate them and bring them back into the core over time. And then the other thing is a mistake, and we've learned from our mistakes over 20 years, is leverage. So for example, in 2009, as we came out and we were in the financial crisis, we had too much leverage in the underlying stocks. And so we delevered on that basis set, and we remain focused on safe balance sheets now, which is one of the reasons we've got all that buyback activity I mentioned earlier.
And just delving a little bit more, obviously, we've got a predominantly IR audience. Do you have like some good examples or techniques that you find innovative or effective when it comes to how companies are presenting information about the business?
The best IR directors are where they're the IR director, but they're also something else. So they might be head of strategy. So Currys is a good example. Vodafone is another good example. Because they're in the business, they're part of the management team. You know, they can convey with confidence the message, the strategy. And when you have that module, you're in contact with them very regularly because they're contacting you. We're giving our feedback. So there's, you know, where I said we might meet the management, the upper management, 6 to 10 times. On an example like Currys, we might have an email exchange or talk to their IR function 20 to 25, 26 times a year. So there's a very good dialogue both ways. And obviously that gets fed back in to the company and also the board. So that works the best, I think, in terms of the person, the role they have in the company and how they go about executing. In terms of what they can do into the market, I think more communication is good. So we don't like where they just pop up their results meeting twice a year. We like them to do things in the middle. Now, I think there's been a trend away from big capital market days towards chapters. So do 2 hours one quarter on one part of the business, the next quarter do 2 hours on a different part. And that sort of builds up and that helps people new come into the stock, because if it's on the website, they can go on and engage with that. So we like that to happen on a sort of ongoing basis. And then I think we need to see more trips to see companies. That's obviously died during COVID, but it's picking up. I just went to see one of our companies in Europe. Clive's going to see the Bullring, which is owned by one of our companies. And then another good medium is a dinner, because you can get 2 or 3 hours. You'll have people who own the shares and then new people that they can pitch to. And then it's a two-way process as well. So they'll probably talk for two of the hours, and then we'll give our feedback for half an hour. So that's a very good medium. And I can think over the 20 years, some signature dinners, which have been turning points on different stocks like Standard Life. As it was then, it's called ABDRN now, if I've got that right. And DS Smith, which has just been taken over. There's been some signature dinners on that. And then another one was when Granada was taken over by Compass. There was a dinner that night. And you say you remember these dinners, and they can be quite important twisting points in the share price performance. The other thing I think companies can do, I think they've got to be audacious in this sort of world of low valuation. We've had this a few times where we've owned a stock, we sold it on valuation, and it's come all the way back, and the chief executive has written to us and say, look, this is where I am in the strategy, it's this performance, I'd like to come and meet you. Now, we're always going to say yes. And normally when they do that, they're confident about their businesses. There's some techniques like that where they could write to 10 targets and they'll probably get 8 meetings. You know, that might be better than trying to get a roadshow filled by a broker phoning up people trying to fill the stock. So I think a bit of audaciousness, a bit of differentiation on top of all the other things I've talked about is a way to sort of think about things.
Yeah, that reaching out directly is a great suggestion. Actually, we don't see that many companies doing that, particularly when it comes from the senior leadership team. So I think that really excellent suggestions there that hopefully will be picked up by lots of IRs listening to this podcast. And what would a perfect meeting look like when you meet face-to-face with a management team and or investor relations?
So we don't ever go through them presenting their presentation, because obviously we listen to it on the webcast. And that's why these webcasts are good, because if you go back 30 years, it would probably be more them presenting the presentation because it hasn't been looked at. So we don't ever go through the presentation, so it's just Q&A. We'll have our agenda, which we've set up before we go in. It's around balance sheet, capital allocation, this normalized earnings I talked about
before the results, the strategy, what's going on with competitors. So like I said, more recently in the last couple of years, in the last 10 minutes of the meeting, there's more feedback from us to them, both partly around this frustration with the valuation, but also because they're more open because of that for views to come in.
And do you interact, I mean, the broking landscape's contracting, it feels like, quite rapidly in the UK. You've touched on HSBC earlier. Do you still provide feedback via brokers or attend conferences or events led by corporate brokers?
On feedback, we do. So after every meeting, there's always feedback. I think this is where companies could change the dynamic a bit. So sometimes we get asked feedback by people who've arranged the meetings. They've got standard questions, which we answer. That's nothing wrong with that. But I think a better way of going about this would be for the corporate, the actual corporate banking broker who works very closely with them to do the phone calls to get the feedback, because obviously he's right in there and knows all the issues. So I think that'll be a better value add, or the IR director could do it. So I think this is where the IR executive can sort of pick up and move towards the top of that sort of skew of how IR executives do things.
I can agree more, because also if you sat in the meeting, you know what the dialogue was regarding, you know where the pressure points were, or if there are any questions that are still unanswered. So it's a really nice opportunity to just bottom out any questions as well, I think.
Sometimes you can say things to IR directors that you can't say to the management. So that's where this open relationship is quite good. And that's where if more did the feedback themselves, so they'd get that and hear that, which will make their job easier. Because if, you know, normally what we're thinking is not, it's not an extreme position, and so that would make their job easier, I think, as well.
I always think for good IR, you need to have a high sort of EQ, emotional intelligence, because the effectiveness in IR has been able to take that feedback and influence your management team in a way that's effective without necessarily, well, changing things without sort of offending or derailing the strategy in the same time. So it's very important. Yep. On sort of form of communication where you're feeding upwards to management, but can be very effective as well.
Definitely.
So let's chat just briefly about ESG. I'm just interested in, is there something you're tracking across the fund and your approach to sort of responsible investing?
So if we wind back 3 or 4 years ago, I think we were in a bubble for ESG. All of the stocks that were AAA rated were valued on ridiculous ratings, like Ørsted would be one of those. So all of that's come back. And as sort of normal bigger companies like BP have invested in sort of clean energy, that's reduced return on capital as well. So that's put pressure on the ones that were already there. So we've had a bubble that's now burst. And what I think we're seeing now is two things that are quite interesting. First of all, we've got to, as fund managers, work with kind of BP or Glencore and move them from here to here, because that's what's going to help society overall. It's the companies that are big footprints getting better. And so we're working with all our companies to see that. We use MSCI ratings, and what we want to see each year is more upgrades and downgrades. And we've consistently seen that over the last 3 years or so. The other thing that's happening links to macro and Trump. And obviously, there's a row out, if you like, in terms of clean energy. This is part of the BP pressure as well, because they were all in on this. And now they're being asked to sort of come back a bit. And they're indicating, even before Elliott, that their strategy is going to change to make it more balanced, old versus new. And I think Trump changing the dynamic globally will put pressure on other countries to do the same slightly. Otherwise, their energy costs are going to be much higher, and then it's going to be very uncompetitive for our industry. So I think we'll see, because of what's going on from a bigger picture perspective, you know, we come out of fifth gear on some of the E aspects of ESG, you know, down to maybe a third gear. So still moving in the right direction, but slightly less fast. And obviously some of this pulls over to S, because we all went too hard on E. And then when we had Russia, Ukraine, energy prices rose dramatically, and that puts pressure on consumer incomes and the S. So we've got to be careful all of this is done in a balanced framework, I think.
And any thoughts on how companies are sort of communicating around ESG matters, particularly publishing a sort of separate sustainability report, but also I'm interested in how much companies engage with you around governance matters. Like, do you get many opportunities to meet the chair or non-execs of company boards?
So we've, out of 60 stocks, we probably meet 20 to 25 chairmen a year or non-executive directors. Some of them have, and this should be best practice, the top 5 to 7 shareholders, the chairman should come and meet every year. It's a great dialogue to have as well as the executives. Some of the companies where we own 8, 9, 10%, we haven't heard from the chairman for 5 years. And then when issues happen, or we've got views, then we'll go on to them. So I think one of the things companies could do as a best practice should be every year the chairman writes, or the IR comes out and says, do you want to meet the chairman? So that should be best practice. It isn't. So there is quite detailed engagement on that front. The other area, there's lots of engagement on remuneration. If you wind back 2 years ago, there was quite a lot of issues on remuneration. We voted against nearly 10% of all AGMs in the fund, and mainly it was remuneration. In the last 12 months, that's got a lot better. Part of that is because operational performance has got better, but part of that is because they've been less aggressive in terms of the schemes that they've been putting forward.
Excellent advice there on best practice, particularly around offering those meetings. Just as we start to wrap up the conversation, you recently, 5 months ago, started publishing a blog with David Longmore from Hanover Investors Management. In the January edition, you talked about 5 things that you will define 2025. Anything you can elaborate on that, or just tell me a little bit more about the blog, the long and the low of it?
Yeah, well, we started this. He's one of my friends. He's not, it's not related to work. He works in private equity. But the basis of this is it's very, very interesting at the moment. And this is why Clive and I on the funds are very excited at the moment. There's lots going on, macro, micro, geopolitics. And that's what we're focused on this blog that we write, just writing about 4 or 5 interesting things. And obviously, eventually, a lot of those things impact on markets as well. So it's been quite interesting going into some of those dynamics with David on that, but it's only 5 or 6 months old, so we'll see how it progresses over time.
It's a great read, actually, and it's succinct as well. So just for IRs listening, it's well worth subscribing, because you can it's a really nice succinct summary of what's going on and how that might impact equities. And you became just a little bit animated there when you talked about 2025. So are you more positive? We're recording this in February 2025. It sounds like you're positive on the outlook for the current financial year.
Yeah, I think there's 4 sort of buckets that create the basis for being very positive. So one is the macro, obviously seeing interest rate cuts. We saw Bank of England move. We think they'll move more as we go out through this year. And the UK economy is not as bad as market commentary. Market commentary is always very doom and gloom about the UK. I think it's slightly better than that. And then we'll have rate cuts, which will accrete that. So that's the first bucket. Second bucket is this micro I talked about. So companies delivering, performing. The third bucket is valuation. So like we talked about before, cheapest market in the world. Most of our stocks will have to double to get to where their global peer trades. And the fourth bucket is this policy action. What the government might do to change the dynamic on the flow picture, on the valuation picture, on the IPO picture, on the tax base, which is being hollowed out picture. So at the moment, I think this is the most interesting time, probably in the 20 years we've been operating. And that's why we're quite sort of fired up at the moment.
And just final question, if you got one piece of advice, you've actually given some great snippets of best practice advice already. But if you have one piece of advice for our investor relations officers listening to the podcast, what would that be?
I think it's the point I made about where they are on the spectrum of types of IR. I'm not saying they're not confident, but they should step forward and have more contact with fund managers away from the management meetings, do the feedback themselves. Try and bring in this innovative ideas we've talked about. I think that's easier to do in a value-add way if they also do something else in the business, like I said, a strategy or M&A. But all people could sort of lift out, you know, if we've got different divisions of types of IR executive, I think everyone should be looking at like the Coe's example and sort of trying to sort of understand what happens there and how they could bring some of that into their processes.
It is called investor relations, and it's so important to actually remember that, because there's so much that goes on internally, and there's so the results processes are so long and convoluted that
Yes. You
can get too inward focused working in IR, and it's always, Yes. We've always come back to actually it's all about the relationships and the direct relationships, not intermediated relationships with brokers. Yes. to relationships you hold with investors. And the more you understand how you guys are managing your funds, what you're focused on, what kind of companies we're looking for from companies that are communication, the easier that relationship's going to be, and the better relationships you're going to have. So,
yeah, definitely.
And thanks so much for taking part, James.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast. I'm your host, Clara Melia. For more IR insights, please do follow Equatory on LinkedIn and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss an episode. Plus, if you're interested in featuring on this podcast or have any feedback, please email us at info@equatory.com. Once again, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.